Hi, and welcome to the Security Channel podcast from Network Computing. I'm Curtis Franklin, your host for these podcasts. And today we bring you the latest in our ongoing and completely unintentional and unplanned series on identity theft and phishing and keeping customer information secure. This time, I had a chance to sit down with David Zumwalt, who's president and CEO of a company called Privacy Inc. Now, they're involved with products and strategies for protecting customer data. This particular podcast isn't revolving around their products. What we do talk about, though, are some of the big issues. And that's where everyone seems to be focusing right now. It's not so much that we don't have technologies in place, or at least available to us, to take care of some of the problems. It's more of a cultural issue. The people that I talk to continue to say that companies have yet to really get serious about handling the security issues around customer data. One of the major focal points in all of this is whether it's going to take something like congressional intervention to make companies serious. I mean, does it require the possibility of someone in the executive suite going to jail before companies finally get serious about protecting the data that their customers have asked them to hold? Well, we've got more coming on this, and I hope it's interesting to you. I certainly found it interesting because it gives us a way to think about what we're doing with all the products that we end up deploying. Well, as I said, this time we're talking to David Zumwalt. Hope you enjoy the interview, and I'll be back at the end to talk about a few more things. David, it seems like identity theft has been the computer-related crime that's been in the news most often. Is that because it really is the biggest problem out there, or just because we have some sort of special fear of identity theft?
It's more of a combination of the old and the new. Identity theft is the largest crime in the world, and until recently, the online portion was only a fraction, 10 to 15% or so, of all forms of identity theft. So it's a very old crime that is evolving quickly to take advantage of the reach and easy access that's afforded through the use of internet and the internet and other networks.
Okay, we're going to spend most of this interview talking about the computer side, but I want to back up and ask you about something. Most of us think of identity theft as being a product of the computer and the internet era. Are you saying that's not true?
In the past, it has not been true. It's clearly true today. Internet, identity theft, if you think about it, it's really just a financial crime. No one would want to be you unless you have something that's worth taking. And so if the prospect of stealing your identity or creating an imposter kind of relationship where you are masquerading as someone else in order to be able to take advantage of their financial capacity, that can happen online or offline. And if you think about the old scams, the African scams, for example, where the person sends the fax that says, hey, I'm trying to shelter some money out of this African nation that's undergoing a civil war. Those scams go back 20 to 30 years or so, and that's a form of identity theft. But the rapid rise in identity theft from online sources should give everyone great concern, because it's so easy to commit this type of crime, and clearly consumers and businesses are falling for it.
Okay. Now, you mentioned both businesses and consumers, and I want to look at each of those for a moment.
Sure.
How widespread is the problem at an individual level? The organization or the person who's trying to, through what we've come to call phishing, or other means, trying to take personal information one consumer at a time?
Well, if we talk about phishing, for example, first, and this is primarily a consumer statistic, since last October, the Anti-Phishing Working Group reported that the active number of phishing sites grew from just slightly under 1,200 to slightly under 3,400 by May of this year. That's it tripled basically in 6 months or so time. The problem with phishing is that phishing can come to you in a way that looks legitimate. We want to be able to trust what we're doing online, so when we have online banking relationships, or perhaps we're using eBay or whatever it is that we're doing, and we get a message that looks like it's coming from a trusted partner, such as that, asking for us to verify account information or whatever, many of us don't think twice about responding to that. And the process of clicking through an email message, a phished message, can enable you to share information directly to the criminal. To drive the point home, think about the way spam works. I mean, we all know how to identify spam. We're pretty good at it. The reality is a spam message gets a consumer response just a fraction of the time. We're talking about, in some cases, one out of every 10,000 or 100,000 spam messages actually gets someone to take action on it. But phishing messages look so real and look so legitimate that we've seen statistics as high as 5, even 10% of phishing messages can generate a reaction and a response from the intended victim. So these numbers clearly are growing. The statistics I quoted a few minutes ago show that it's a ripe ground for continued abuse. We don't yet have consumers who have developed enough of an awareness of just how to take care online to feel comfortable that this problem is going to go away anytime soon.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing for you to say. Given the things that I read, and admittedly I'm part of the industry, but it doesn't seem possible that someone with a computer could not have heard about this sort of attack over the last 6 to 12 months.
I think the problem is more, you're right, you're absolutely right, but I think the problem is more fundamental. If you think about the way you develop trust with someone else, and now I'm focusing on our consumer experience here for a minute. We can talk about business here in a little while. But if I were to meet you on the street and come and greet you, the likelihood that you would respond to me or share details that might be intimate about yourself or your career, very, very low probability that you would do that until you had some basis for trusting me, right? I mean, that's the way we handle our intimate relationships with spouses. It's the way we develop business partnerships. It's the way that we go shopping. We're not going to shop in a store and spend a lot of money there until we're sure that they have the product that we want or that they have the ability to deliver consistently on what it is that we want. When we're working online, though, how do you establish that trust? Your trust is established really with the internet browser that you're using. And so if a site looks right, if it looks like it's eBay or if it looks like it's Bank of America or any of a number of other sites that it could be, then if the logos are in place and it seems like a legitimate request, how do we know that we're working with the person or the company or the entity that we think we're working with? So it's not that consumers are that gullible. It's really about how do they develop the skills and the awareness to know how to identify reality from criminal behavior. And then what tools can they put in place to make sure that they're continuing to operate safely online?
Okay, well let's talk about this, and you're right, we're going to get to the whole business and commercial side in just a few minutes. But from the consumer side, it seems like there are two components, the behavioral and the technological.
Right.
Let's start with the technological. What do we need that we don't yet have in place to help protect people against phishing attacks?
Well, the good news there is that technology is developing all the time, and I'll certainly acknowledge that our company is a part of the myriad of companies that are bringing technologies to bear. But I won't talk about that specifically. Instead, I'll just point to the fact that, you know, 10 years or so ago, we didn't see much in the way of antivirus software in the industry. But when the virus threat became real, we've seen many companies step up and develop capabilities that we now all use. We're probably using antivirus software on our home computers and also in our offices. Similarly, when we began to develop our love affair for broadband, and we got high-speed cable or a DSL service or what have you, the need to utilize firewall software and hardware came into play. And once again, we saw the industry really step up. And in many cases, we're using firewall technologies on our home computers and our office computers today. In some cases, the service provider provides that for us. Now, over the last few years, we've seen the emergence of spam filtering technologies. We've also seen spyware software come into the marketplace. And if you just think back 5 years or so ago, not that long ago, it was not that long ago when most of us would not have known what spyware was or why we would need spyware software or why we would need firewall software or any of these other things that have come into to play. The point is the internet and computer technology and the applications that reside on this are so compelling, they become compelling in our lives, both at home and at work, that we're willing to put up with some of the threats and vulnerabilities that we're now facing, and we're willing to invest in these technologies to help us ferret out what's real and what's not, because the internet and this software is providing so much convenience for our busy lives. So the good news is technology is coming that will help us eradicate these types of problems in the future. But the flip side of that message is it's just very, very important for consumers in particular to apply the same common sense that they were taught as children by their parents. Don't talk to strangers, you know, or pay attention when you're in unusual surroundings, and don't be too trusting until you know why you're doing business and that you have a reason for trusting whoever's on the other end of that online conversation or relationship.
Okay. Well, that the whole issue of trust brings us to the other side of the equation, and that is the commercial side.
Right.
You know, as a business, what can I do to help my customer know that he or she can trust the information when I need to communicate with them via the internet or via email? Well, David, that's good on the consumer side, but let me ask from the other side of the equation, as a company, what can I do to help my customer trust the information that he or she gets from me, either via the web or through email, or is the only answer that I can't legitimately communicate with my customers that way?
No, the good news here again is that businesses are highly motivated to take care of their customers. It's the way every business gets paid. So businesses are very aware of the need to step up their own efforts to improve the mechanisms they can use to build trust with their consumers. In some cases, these are business-to-business relationships, so let's not rule that out. But first, let's take banks, for example. Banks love online banking as much as consumers do. Banks and credit card companies have a vested interest in making sure that the transactions that are completed online are both secure and trustworthy, because if they're not, then the financial risk that accrues to the financial institution can be large. already. We're all familiar with the identity theft advertising that one of the major credit card companies has done, and we're certainly aware of the fraud control mechanisms that are in place. We've heard stories or perhaps even experienced a credit card company or bank calling to verify that a transaction that we've just made is real. In some cases, they can spot fraudulent transactions that way. So banks, credit card companies, and other enterprises, other businesses are already hard at work to try to eliminate the risk or at least manage the risk that's associated with this criminal activity that's happening in the background. So the first order of business is that just remember that businesses themselves trust or have to trust what their customers are telling them about the experience of working online in order to know that to have a positive ongoing relationship with those consumers, they're going to have to bring applications or services into the marketplace to make it easy to do business with them. But businesses have a bigger problem, too, because they're often victimized by the same things that consumers are victimized by. A phishing attack can be used to successfully harvest confidential information from inside a company. A phishing victim doesn't necessarily have to be a consumer. In some cases, it could be someone masquerading as a customer or masquerading as a service provider or someone who's a legitimate provider in industry. These types of problems can lead to massive financial losses on the part of companies that fall victim themselves. And we're beginning to see some of those stories come out into the press today. The more recent ones, over the last few months anyway, have had to do with data that has been mishandled by, in some cases, other service providers. A shipping company loses a backup tape that has sensitive customer information on it that then cannot be found. Or another company, one of the legal search businesses, was inadvertently providing access to customers or to individuals who are not their customers who are doing lookups on in areas of data that they were not permitted to see. So businesses have to be concerned about their own brand erosion, their own real costs of managing against this type of fraud, and at the same time assuring their customers that they're doing everything they can, both from a technology point of view and from best practices, to stay ahead of this problem. The point, I've thrown a lot of terminology and perhaps some concepts at you, but the real point comes down to this. Businesses have to look not only at a reactive posture to these types of problems, but they have to get in front of the problem too. There's a variety of approaches that can be taken preventatively to make sure that businesses are doing everything they can do to not present such a tempting target for phishers or for other forms of, you know, email criminals themselves.
Okay. Well, can we talk about it? I mean, if someone were to come to you and say, what are the four or five things that virtually every company that handles sensitive customer information should make sure they're doing? I mean, what would those top four or five things be?
Well, the first, for a company, I would say the first would be do not collect any information, any sensitive information, beyond that which you absolutely need. In the past, many companies collected background information, social security numbers, other identifiers from customers under the premise that the more that we knew about you, the better we could serve you. I mean, on the surface, that sounds like a wonderful concept. If I know you better, then I can anticipate your needs better, right? But when all that becomes is a large collection of data, then that data represents a pretty tempting target. So first order of business, don't collect, don't store any more sensitive information than you have to in order to provide service for a customer. Second, look at what you're doing in your own back office to provide an approach that helps prevent these types of problems from recurring. No business can hide under the sort of the protection of, well, we're no worse than anyone else at using encryption or using firewalls or whatever would represent current technology. I mean, the reality is this type of criminal behavior is growing astronomically. Identity theft is the largest crime in the world, and this can have dramatic impact on not only your customer satisfaction, but your ability of your business to stay in business going forward. So preventatively, it means getting in front of the problem with tools that are coming into the marketplace that don't just secure the transaction, but secures the way that you do business with your consumers. The rest are really common sense items that that would apply to consumers as well. If you suspect something is happening that looks amiss, make some noise about it. Move it up the line. Protect the information you're giving out as a business or as a consumer, such as your email address. Don't post it in places where it's going to be public or places where it's going to be so public that it could be abused or misused. Finally, I would just say that the common sense, this sounds like a throwaway line, but it's not, but common sense served you very well when you were learning how to be safe as a child and as a teenager, and it'll serve you very well today. Use common sense, know your surroundings, and don't do things that are just, stupid because they're easy.
Well, the common sense portion is one of those things where, as far as I know, we don't have to wait on a particular vendor upgrade cycle to get to common sense.
Right.
That is available, has been available, and yet it's obvious that there are organizations out there that have not been acting with common sense. Now, a lot of people believe that it's only a matter of time before the federal government steps in and creates laws or regulations that deal with the collection, storage, and use of personal information. Do you think that it's going to take something like federal legislation to convince people that it's worth engaging the common sense that they have? Or is this something where the addition of laws or regulations is going to only add overhead?
I think that there's a balance there, and I know that is perhaps hard to at first adjust, but if we look at this globally, we see that the same thing is happening in different cultures around the world. In some cases, countries have stronger privacy laws than we do here in the United States, but they are struggling with the same types of fraud. So if you think about regulation as just being an expression of the American citizens' concern about what's happening in their lives, voiced through their representatives, then yes, regulation will become a more pressing and a more urgent matter to the degree that businesses either can handle it on their own or won't handle it on their own. The vast majority of businesses want nothing more than to do what's right by their customer, because that's how they stay in business. So we will see some regulation, especially to the extent that it helps standardize efforts in the industry and perhaps put some teeth into the punishment that's available for criminals that insist on or continue to persist in perpetrating these crimes. But regulation won't be the only factor that's moving that gets companies to react. Now, I talked a minute ago about prevention, and I want to kind of bring a case in point. Sometimes we all do get comfortable with the way things are, and we're not thinking about the way things are going to be. When the first internet browser came out, for example, and Netscape went public as the first internet company to do so, people weren't really thinking about internet browsing except for perhaps a small handful, and now we all do it. So a sea change took place when that technology came about. At that time, companies were seeing the risks and vulnerabilities as being primarily perimeter risks, kind of like your home security system or your car alarm system. But if I can protect what's inside this protected zone, then I'll be fine. If I can protect the contents of my house, if I can protect my car. But in reality, what we're seeing now are transactional risks. And these are risks where you have people doing business with each other or many companies doing business with each other. And as we're seeing more and more of the everything from order management systems to the way supply chains work to just communication on contracts, as that begins to become more diverse and diversified, and we see more and more outsourcing, then businesses are becoming increasingly virtual. And within that world where we're not defined by boundaries or perimeters, but instead we're defined by transactions, the kind of thinking that needs to come into the marketplace now from everyone is, how do we protect those transactions, not just provide a nice secure moat around the place we used to call home or the, you know, place we call our office. So it's a little bit of a conceptual, you know, play on that, but I think that two or three years out, we'll be looking back and thinking about the emergence of transactional solutions to deal with these types of problems.
Okay. You mentioned two or three years out. I think one of the big questions is, as consumers already report that they're altering their behavior online to deal with the threat of identity loss, are we at the point of turning the corner on this, or do you see it becoming a more serious problem before enough companies and individuals act to actually make it get better?
I think it will be a while before we see the problem get better, because for the first time we're dealing with what's truly a global risk. And the fact that we in the United States might pass a law or might develop technologies that can protect transactions domestically won't work worldwide when you have a very diverse fabric of privacy regulations, and you also have a very uneven enforcement of laws around identity theft or other forms of financial fraud. Many of the phishing attacks, in fact, the majority, originate from outside the United States. So this is truly a global problem. So it will be a while before we see this come under control. But one of the analyst organizations has projected that identity theft could top $1 trillion this year, by the end of this year, in terms of global losses. That's a lot of money, and that's going to attract a lot of brain power to try to solve that problem. Anytime you have those types of financial losses, you'll see banks, credit card companies, enterprises, service providers, telephone companies, regulators all stepping in to try to find ways to bring that under control, because no one wants to lose $1 trillion, starting with the consumer who, you know, had money filched out of their bank account.
Right.
So that's providing plenty of impetus to get people to focus on this problem, and I am confident that it will be brought under control, but it will not be tomorrow. It'll be still a couple of years, perhaps even longer out.
Well, David, it sounds like this is a conversation we may well get to have again as things move along, and before the problem, if it can be solved, is solved. But I very much appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
I look forward to talking to you again in the future, and hopefully we will have better news on all fronts.
Well, that was David Zumwalt. Certainly appreciate him taking the time to sit down and talk with me over the phone. I do most of these over the phone, and I hope that the quality is okay. I kind of like it, but then again, I'm biased. I'm the one doing them. Listen, I have a favor to ask of the folks who are listening to this. One of the questions that we have as we're trying to develop podcasts is what you want to hear. Drop me a line. I mean, I've been doing some of these longer interviews. Is that what you want, or would you rather have something, say, in the 10-minute range? I don't know. Do me a favor. Send an email to cfranklin@nwc, that's NovemberWhiskeyCharlie.com, and let me know what you want. We can do podcasts in a whole variety of formats. And like most other publications, we're working hard just to figure out what it is that's most useful to you and what you want to listen to on your iPod. So drop me a line, let me know, and we'll see if we can't make this a better experience, more enjoyable, and more useful for you. Anyway, until next week, when we've got another very nice interview lined up, this is Curtis Franklin for the Security Channel podcast of Network Computing, saying so long.
to find? Where are you flying?